Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning local news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, lawmakers meet for a special session to address ongoing coronavirus relief, tweaks to election plans, and more. After the Utah legislature refused to extend a state of emergency for the pandemic, Governor Gary Herbert issues a new emergency declaration himself. And a state senator's $10 donation to a protester leads to an investigation. On the phone for the show today, we have Salt Lake Tribune reporter Bethany Rogers. Good morning, Bethany, and welcome.
Thank you.
Also on the phone, we've got reporter Taylor Stevens. Hi, Taylor. Welcome to you.
Good morning.
Good morning. And news columnist Robert Gerke. Good morning to you, Robert.
Good morning, Roger.
Good morning. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments. Tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. You can also call 801-355-8255 to be a part of this conversation. Well, a special session of the legislature yesterday, bills passed, many of them COVID-related and several that were not. Bethany and Taylor, you both covered this session. Maybe we can talk about the COVID-related and pandemic relief items first. Basically, a lot of doling out of that relief money. Taylor or Bethany, some of that was for unemployment benefits. Some of it was for beefing up testing. This will sound like a lot, but can one of you give us the sort of, you know, overview of funding for COVID relief?
Yeah, so the budget bill that the legislature took up yesterday distributed the last installation of the CARES Act funding. It was about $122 million that they assigned out, with about $25 million of that for broadband internet access in eastern and northern parts of Utah. There was some $40 million to harder hit industries, including mining and the arts, and about $15 million for the state's public health lab to add an overnight shift so that they could keep working through the night and improve turnaround times for coronavirus tests and other tests for different viruses. There were a lot of other things included in that bill, too. There was some money for PPE. There was some money for outreach. There was some money for adding intensive care beds. So it was a big roundup of different forms of coronavirus-related aid.
And there's also some funding, I guess, related to rental assistance. Can you talk about that as well? This is sort of a change of language for who can access rental assistance if they've been impacted or have seen negative impacts, I guess, of this pandemic. Can you describe that?
So that was actually
This is Taylor. Sorry. This was a second bill that passed through the legislature, and this one was tweaking the Federal CARES Act dollar programs. So this is one of the changes. Previously, tenants had to attest that they had suffered financial harm as a result of the pandemic. Now they only have to say they have had a negative impact to be eligible for those dollars, which is apparently going to be a lower threshold. And it's also opened up to landlords so that they can apply on behalf of their tenants, with the idea that that will make it easier to distribute this money to people who need it and avoid evictions right now.
Okay, and that's a separate bill, as you pointed out. I think back in the overarching budget bill, Bethany, there was a lot of money to give an unemployment benefit to residents to Utahns who have lost their jobs because of the pandemic. Specifically, what does that do?
Yeah, that's a $138 million FEMA, actually, appropriation that they're using to provide that $300 per week unemployment benefit. It will only last for about 3 weeks, and it's retroactive, so it'll go from July 26th to August 15th, and it could take some time for people who are unemployed to get that aid. But it's kind of a way, I guess, some of the lawmakers were saying to kind of step down from the $600 a week additional federal unemployment aid that people were receiving earlier in the pandemic.
Okay. And covering, again, a period of time that has already passed, July 26th through, you said, August 15th. I mean, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I mean, we could dig into any one of these items, but I think I'm going to keep us moving along. And Taylor, you covered the fact that there are going to be changes to how the election happens come November. In what way?
Yeah, so this is sort of the second election that has been run in Utah during the coronavirus pandemic. During the primary election, Utah conducted almost an entirely by-mail election, and they're broadening out their scope a little bit for the November election. They're allowing a lot more options for people. So there'll be outdoor options, in-person voting, drive-through options, drop boxes, mail-in balloting, and it's up to each county to decide what options they want to provide to the voters in their counties.
There was a provision in this bill originally that got stripped out that had to do with basically canceling in-person voting altogether in certain places, depending upon, I guess, coronavirus case counts. Is that correct?
Yeah, so originally the Lieutenant Governor's office would have had the ability, as you said, to cancel those in-person voting stations if there was a spike in the coronavirus. However, the bill wasn't very specific about what circumstances would need to be met in order to cancel an in-person election. And some lawmakers were a little, unsure or wary of that fact. And there was also a public commenter during interim committee meetings that raised some concerns about the lieutenant governor having that power when he's also running as a candidate himself for governor, Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox. Ultimately, the legislature decided to strip that element of the bill, so that's no longer an option. They feel that there are enough options for people if there is a spike that they can do drive-through or outdoor, that they'll have enough options that if the coronavirus does, you know, have a fall increase, that people will still be able to vote and maintain their safety at the same time.
I'll add that there was another proposed change to the rules around voting, actually two other sort of proposed rules that didn't get accepted, having to do with when ballots get sent out and then when they can be mailed back in. And Taylor, can you just kind of give us the overview there?
Yeah, so these were two changes that were sought by county clerks across the state. They wanted a little bit more time in case of a coronavirus outbreak, or, you know, we've been having a lot of national conversation about some slowdowns in the mail as a result of some changes on the national level to the Postal Service. So they wanted an extra week to mail out ballots, 28 days before the election rather than 21. And then they were also hoping for an extra week in the canvass period. And they did do an extra week in the canvass period for the primary, but no counties needed it. So the lawmakers felt that those weren't necessary. However, those changes did have the support of all of the county clerks in the state. And there was a floor amendment that ended up failing. So those provisions will not be part of this November's election.
Okay, so you still have the same amount of time to get them back in, and you can't mail them back in on the day of the election, because in-person voting will be basically a possibility. There's a lot. I'm realizing that I skipped over a big part of the relief aid that Bethany covered, which has to do with state-run medical and dental clinics. They had actually, been forced to kind of shutter, I think, because of a lack of funding. They've been refunded, Bethany?
Not entirely. So the legislature last session cut their annual $2.6 million subsidy, and they're restoring about $500,000 in one-time funding, which apparently will be just enough to keep the Salt Lake Clinic only open until the next general session, where it sounds like they'll revisit the issue and sort of decide what to do from there. But clinics in Ogden and Provo have already closed due to lack of funding.
Before there's other parts of the special session that I want to jump into, but let's bring Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke into the conversation. And Gerke, just on, pandemic relief and then on voting provisions that we were talking about, anything you want to weigh in on here?
Yeah. Sorry, I'm having a hard time hearing you, but I think, these special sessions are not even so special anymore because we've had a handful of them now, right?
Right.
It kind of shows the way that the legislature and the governor are scrambling to try to make ends meet and meet some of the needs that have been created by the pandemic as well. It was a fairly long list of bills that they got through. They got through them quickly, as they're quite efficient when you have one party rule. But you know, that some of this was pretty essential. That some of the funding items were essential. Some of them, as you were mentioning, with the dental assistance, came up a little bit short of where I think the public would like to see it. But, you know, and this is probably not the last of these special sessions. We're still dealing with the economic turmoil and some of the social turmoil, and I suspect we'll see others in the near future.
Probably not the last, although the House Speaker, Brad Wilson, says that we shouldn't become a full-time legislature, that's a sort of dangerous precedent to set. You know, on the topic of pandemic relief, the legislature did not extend the state of emergency that Utah was under, but Governor Gary Herbert did. And so, Bethany, we'll pause actually the legislative coverage for just a second, and I'll ask, what does that emergency declaration do or mean for Utah?
Well, the emergency declaration is kind of a restart to the declarations that Gary Herbert had issued earlier this year, and it's more limited in nature than all of the orders that had been in place previously. So the orders themselves are primarily targeted at avoiding the loss of federal emergency relief dollars and making sure that that money can continue to flow into Utah. There was some debate and a little bit of lack of clarity about whether a state of emergency was necessary in order to accept that money. But I think that to be on the safe side, they continued those. I saw that there was an order on continuing, to require masks inside of state buildings. So there's a variety of aspects to this that they just wanted continuity on, but they also wanted to sort of revisit the entire list, I guess, of the orders and statements that the governor has put out during the pandemic and sort of start from the ground up.
I mentioned, and this is maybe kind of getting into the weeds, but I mentioned that Utah House Speaker, I mentioned Brad Wilson before, and he's not a fan of this state of emergency. I guess, why not?
So the legislature has received a lot of pushback over the states of emergency. I think there's a lot of constituents out there who want to see them, you know, be lifted and to go back to life as usual. And I think that Speaker Wilson mentioned that, you know, he just felt that there were so many orders and that, you know, it was really time to go back to the drawing board with them. And maybe not all of them are useful anymore at this point in the pandemic. So I wouldn't say that he's entirely opposed to the idea of an emergency order. He said that he was supportive of the governor issuing, you know, a more limited version of the order yesterday. He wasn't opposed to the action that the governor took. But I think that he wanted to eliminate, you know, it cut off orders that were no longer necessary.
Got it. How long are these resolutions, this emergency declaration, how long will they be in place? I mean, I think
they're effective through September 21st, I believe.
Okay, so another 30 days, and then I kind of imagine that we'll return to that conversation, even on this show. Before we head to a break, this isn't exactly COVID-related, but another item that came out of this special session has to do with who can run the Utah Department of Health, meaning who can be its director, and a sort of tailor-made bill for a specific person. Bethany and Taylor, you both covered this one as well. What changes does this bill make? And I'm not certain who to direct that question to.
I can take that question. So okay. The state's law at this point does not require the head of the health department to have a medical degree to be a physician, although most of the directors of the health department have. However, if someone isn't a physician, there's some requirements for the length of time that you have to put in the field of public health. So there was a requirement that you'd have to have a master's degree of public health or public administration, or if you don't have that, you would have to have 7 years of professional experience with at least 5 of those in a senior administrative level position. So the new interim head of the health department doesn't meet that criteria. His name is Richard Saunders, and he's only had 5 years at the Utah Department of Health. Before that, he was largely a management consultant in the private sector. He worked in retail and construction and IT. So he doesn't meet the current requirements. So they wanted to come back and shave a couple of years off of the requirement for working in the field of public health, taking it from 7 to 5, with only 3 of those in a senior administrative position, which is exactly the amount that Richard Saunders has. And this wasn't a secret at all. The sponsor of the bill, Senator Alan Christensen, he was very clear that this was a bill that was written in order to accommodate Richard Saunders and allow him to be the permanent appointee. The second aspect of the bill would relate to the deputy director of the health department. So before this bill, the law requires the deputy director to be a physician if the executive director is not. And that provision was taken out. So it would have been taken out. They wanted to give more flexibility in that area. So now the executive director can have up to 2 deputy, can have 2 deputy directors, and at least one of them has to be a physician. The other one has to have experience in the field of public health but doesn't need to be a physician.
A question that I have is there have been a few changes at the helm of this department since the start of the pandemic. Can you describe that for us? Why have there been these kind of this rolling head of the department of the health department here in Utah?
Yeah. So toward the beginning of the pandemic, they brought in a new head of the health department to handle sort of the day-to-day operations because Dr. Joseph Miner, who is a physician and who had been leading the health department since 2015, apparently has some health conditions that put him at risk for COVID. So he was kind of on work from home, and they felt that someone needed to be able to come in person and be there for sort of like the day-to-day response. So they appointed General Jeff Burton, who is from the National Guard, to that position. He has basically been the one who's leading up the state's coronavirus response from the health department side. General Burton served, I believe, through the end of July, but he's also got some things going on. I don't think he was ever expected to remain permanently in that position. And he's also running for to be a state representative, so for a House seat. So that's not really compatible with serving at the head of the health department as well. So he stepped aside at the end of July, and then they brought in Richard Saunders, who during the pandemic has been sort of serving as General Burton's deputy, his right-hand man for the COVID response.
Okay, and then this bill making it easier for him, who's, as interim head, to become permanent head of the department. Robert Gerke, I think I want to bring you on this before we head to a break. Who gets to run the health department? This bill expanding who is eligible and to make it so that Richard Saunders can take over permanently. Any thoughts there?
Well, it does seem like there's probably plenty of good people who do have medical experience who could run the office. It's not necessarily essential, I don't think, because if you have people who do have that experience working for you, it's more of a management position. But, I think there's value in having the expertise. And, ultimately, I guess it's up to the governor and the legislature to decide on what standards they want for the people who are working for them. But I think it would be, fairly surprising to have somebody who doesn't have, say, public safety experience running the Department of Public Safety, or doesn't have, a considerable amount. So, we'll see how this goes and kind of keep an eye on it. But it does seem like, they're watering down the standards for the head of the department. And it's something that was done with the agreement of both the governor and the legislature, unlike sort of this emergency orders that you guys discussed. I mean, that's sort of a power struggle between the two, and it's one that's been going on for a while. Who calls the shots in these scenarios? And right now, I guess that goes back to the head of the Department of Health that is side B.
Yeah. That's Robert Gerke, who is a news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. And we need to head to our first break in the show. I think I want to get to one more bill that passed, a resolution on public lands, when we come back. A reminder that you're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. Stay with us.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members in Silicon Slopes Magazine, focused on Utah tech and startup industries, supporting good causes that affect us all. Information about weekly town hall meetings or advertising in the magazine at siliconslopesmagazine.com, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn.
On this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Queer Eye's Karamo Brown, famous for getting people to talk about their most intimate feelings, tells us how he would get Joe Biden to cry.
It takes nothing at all. I would just be like, black people, and he'd be like, South Carolina.
And Peter Sagal will join us for more psychology, plus Samantha Bee, Will Arnett, and a pharaoh. It's the News Quiz from NPR.
Tune in Saturday morning at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined via the phone by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Bethany Rogers and Taylor Stevens, and by news columnist Robert Gerke. It is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by tweeting to us. Just be sure to name check us. Our handle is at KCPW. You can also call 801-355-8255. Well, just to close out coverage of the special session, lawmakers passed a resolution, a sort of message to the federal government that the state wants more money, greater compensation for public lands within its borders. And this has to do with the payment in lieu of taxes program, or PILT payments. Bethany, what is the background here? Bethany Rogers, I know there was a recent study that kind of drove this resolution.
Yeah, the Utah legislature for some time has been looking at a way to convince the federal government to give them more reimbursement and compensation for the property taxes lost because so much of Utah is publicly held and doesn't generate any property tax revenue. So they believe that the federal government is basically shortchanging them greatly on this money, and that is making it harder for counties to fund basic services and education. So last year, they signed a big contract with a software firm that is designing this program to basically evaluate put a price tag on the public lands in the state, and then from there calculate what the property taxes might be and how much the state is losing out on. And then they wanted to take that number and present it to the federal government and basically say, hey, this is how much you owe us. So the software was presented to them earlier this year, completed, and a big report with, you know, a lot of findings about, you know, this is how much the land would be worth and would generate per year if it were simply taken out of the federal government's hands and privatized. This is how much you could get if it were developed in some way. So there were a lot of different ways of looking at it. But basically, the major finding was that simply privatizing the land could result in $534 million a year in property tax revenues. So the idea this last session was to take that number and put it in a resolution and call on Congress and the president to give Utah that much money each year, saying this is how much we would have had if these lands were not in your hands.
Right, but okay, go ahead, yeah.
No, that's much, much more than what the federal government is actually paying, which is about $40 million a year.
Got it. And I was going to say that's more than 10 times the amount that they currently get. But then also this, as you said, the idea was to put that figure, $534 million, into a resolution and then present that to the federal government. But in the end, they didn't do that. I mean, not exactly. Why not?
Well, it's a little bit complicated, but it turns out that there could have been some unintended consequences to doing that. So during the committee hearing on the resolution, some lawmakers from rural parts of the county where agriculture is a big part of the industry had some real concerns that the software program didn't take into account some greenbelt tax benefits that farmers and ranchers receive for their land. So apparently a lot of the land that they have is covered by this, you know, tax benefit that's designed to keep land in farming and ranching. And so they believed that that $534 million figure was greatly inflated because it didn't include that tax benefit. And they were concerned that, you know, if the state was demanding this while discounting the tax benefit from the federal government, that would kind of turn the heads of some of the county assessors who are like, well, why can't we reap that same amount of money from the lands that are covered by this tax benefit, and that there would be more pressure to repeal some of those incentives to farmers and ranchers. So ultimately, they decided to remove the number from the resolution, which is kind of interesting because it cost them $700,000 to this software company just to derive that number in the first place. But, you know, they concluded that, you know, there wasn't enough support in the legislature to necessarily put that figure into the resolution, that they didn't really want to go down that road. So they were much more vague in the resolution that they ended up passing, basically just saying this $40 million is inadequate and we want more. And they kind of made a sidelong allusion, I guess, to the fact that they believe they're owed more than $500 million because they said that the $41 million was only 8% of what they think that they're entitled to, which, you know, is simple math to get to $534 million again. But that figure itself doesn't appear in the resolution anymore.
I guess, you know, this is a resolution, and I'm wondering, does the federal government actually do anything with these resolutions? I mean, this is a message to them. Will anything happen as a result of this resolution, Bethany?
I'm not sure. I mean, the resolution states that copies of the resolution should be sent to the federal delegation, to Congress, to the president. But, you know, in talking to people, it doesn't really sound like they believe the resolution itself will necessarily, you know, affect change. I think that the goal is to maybe convince other Western states to take a similar approach and maybe build some kind of a coalition that could end up convincing the federal government to give everybody more money for their public land.
Yeah, and of course, then in the background also is the movement to actually get those lands disposed of, meaning transferred out of the hands of the federal government and into local into state hands. But that's I guess allied but secondary story. Robert Gerke, news columnist, do you want to weigh in on this resolution demanding more money from PILT?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is something that the state legislature has been banging the drum on for decades, to be honest, this PILT funding. And this resolution is non-binding. But as Bethany noted, this to get to this figure cost us about $700,000. The story behind that is that Representative Ken Ivory secured funding for this study right before he left to go work for the company that was given the contract to do the study. So there was a little bit of self-dealing there. But, you know, we get to this figure and then take the figure out. I think the point that's raised by these rural ranchers and farmers is legitimate, that there are benefits to public land that go beyond just getting a paycheck from the federal government. You know, so the state's going to continue to make noise over this. It's something that has never really gotten much traction, and there are other states that keep making noise over this. And it just seems like to throw additional money after money we're not getting is a little bit futile. And I don't think the federal government at this point is in a position or inclined to make this a high priority for the scarce federal dollars. So, you know, it's fine, I guess, if they want to write letters essentially to the federal delegation and to the president saying that they want more money. I think in the long run, it's going to see very little benefit.
Okay. That's Robert Gerke, news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. A reminder to listeners that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-TALK or tweeting to us. Our handle is at KCPW. I want to tackle a couple of pieces of news about people in government. One, the departure of a high-ranking official. The other, an investigation into a state senator. Just on the first, the legislature yesterday commended Kristen Cox, who holds a key role in the governor's office, but who is leaving. Taylor Stevens, again, this is a joint effort between you and Bethany Rogers, the reporting here. But for those who are not steeped in the kind of inner workings of state government, who is Kristen Cox and why is she leaving the governor's cabinet?
Yeah, I actually think, Bethany Rogers has been doing a lot of reporting on Kristen Cox over the years, so I think maybe she would be better able to address that.
Bethany, to you.
Yeah. So Kristen Cox is a very powerful member of Gary Herbert's cabinet. She is in charge of the governor's Office of Management and Budget. And so basically she oversees a lot of the efficiencies, the workforce in state government, and then also in her department is in charge of crafting Governor Herbert's yearly budget proposal and sort of working that through the legislature. And yes, as you noted, she received citations from the legislature yesterday ahead of her departure from state government, I guess, in early September, we're hearing.
Okay, and we don't know where she's going. That's not part of this announcement from the governor's office.
No, we don't. Yeah, they said that they're going to leave it up to her to talk about what she wants to do next.
Okay, and she helped usher in a theory of organizations that kind of guided the operations of Utah government, the theory of constraints, which sounds a bit academic. Can you describe what we're talking about there, if you feel comfortable doing that, Bethany?
Yeah, so it's a management philosophy that has been around for about 50 years, I think, and it has its roots in sort of factory work, where the idea is that if you want to improve the performance of an assembly line, for example, you focus on the step in the system that is basically the bottleneck, and you focus all of your resources there instead of spreading your resources out and improving the entire assembly line. And the idea is that that more efficiently uses your available resources to make big improvements in the overall system. So that's sort of a management philosophy that she's pioneered in state government because, by and large, it's used mainly in the private sector, and she's actually commended yesterday in the citations for getting worldwide recognition as a practitioner of the theory of constraint specifically inside of government.
Okay. I'm just looking at our time and realizing that we don't have a lot of it left, but Robert Gerke, do you want to weigh in on this high-profile departure from the governor's office?
I think that without a doubt, Kristen shaped state government. I mean, she pushed for a lot of the efficiency measures, a lot of the, the sort of the metrics that to gauge the accountability and successfulness of programs. Probably she's the former lieutenant governor of Maryland, and it probably also worth noting that she's visually impaired. I mean, if you've been in a meeting with her, it's pretty remarkable the way her mind, retains these facts and figures because she doesn't exactly have notes and so forth in front of her. So, she's a very bright person and has had left a big mark on Utah's state government. Some, don't necessarily like that, some of the reforms she's put in place, but, it'll be interesting to see what she does next.
Okay. Robert Gerke, news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune there again, and Bethany Rogers and Taylor Stevens also on the line, two reporters from the Salt Lake Tribune. I want to turn to the other piece of news about people in government. It has to do with Democratic State Senator Derek Kitchen, who is being investigated because of a $10 donation he made to a protester. And Taylor Stevens, could you tackle this story for us? This has to do with a high-profile protest in front of the district attorney's office, the result of which is that protesters are facing some significant charges. This donation, though, that the senator made is actually from a time a little bit earlier than that, I think. Anyway, Taylor Stevens, tell us about this donation and how we know about it.
Yeah, so these court documents were released this week showing that Senator Derek Kitchen, a Salt Lake City senator and former Salt Lake City councilman, as you said, had made a $10 donation to Madalena McNeil, who is one of the protesters who's been charged with a first-degree felony and faces, I believe, life in prison over the buying of paint for the protest at the district attorney's office where protesters painted the street red, and there was some other vandalism that occurred, some broken windows. But what the court documents say is that Kitchen had sent $10 to McNeil prior to this protest, and that he'd used the word paint to describe the donation. And we reached out to him for comment on this, and he told the Tribune that, you know, it's a matter of record that he supports progressive activism, and that he confirmed the donation, but he said he wasn't involved in the planning or organization of the event, and that he does support peaceful protests but doesn't condone violence or vandalism. So that investigation is ongoing.
And again, paint is part of the damage, the vandalism these protesters are facing charges for. I guess did Kitchen describe whether or not he knew how the paint was going to be used, or in the conversation that the Tribune had with him?
So we actually received a statement from him, and he indicated that he was not aware, that he wasn't involved in the planning of the protest. Paint, I think, could apply to paint for posters, possibly, not necessarily the paint on the ground. That'll be up to the investigators and to decide how strong that case is. We did ask Salt Lake City Police spokesman Greg Wilkie, and my colleague Peyton Harkins asked why police are looking into the small donations, because there are a number of other small donations that are under investigation.
Yeah.
And Wilking said that, it's not about the size of the crime, it's what it represents, and that people, paying to get this paint to cause destruction and cost taxpayer money, that should be looked into and investigated. We did reach out also to the Senate leadership. This was a question that was asked also yesterday during Senate media availability, and all Senate leadership has declined to comment on this so far.
Okay. And again, the people who are who is actually investigating this? This is the Salt Lake City Police Department?
I believe so, but it will likely be, I think it's the Salt Lake County District Attorney's Office, but it will likely be conflicted out.
And that's because District Attorney Sim Gill says that he's friends with Senator Kitchen, right?
Right, that they have a personal relationship. But yeah, Salt Lake City is doing the investigation, but, it's probably going to kind of move around and shift as things go on.
This has been, this summer has seen a lot of protests. This particular protest was centered around the police shooting of Bernardo Palacios Carbajal, who was shot after apparently being involved in an armed robbery. He was found with a gun. Robert Gierke, do you think that, that Senator Derek Kitchen might face charges as a result of sending a $10 donation to a protester?
I mean, one would hope not. I mean, you'd hate to see $10 donations become criminal charges. I think they would have a hard time proving that he intended or knew that this was going to be spent on damaging public property. And it's, the prosecution of this particular protest has been, as we've discussed in the past, over the top, and the potential life sentences for the people who damaged the building. I think it's pretty clear that the police and the prosecutors are trying to send a message, and that they're trying to, send a signal that they're not going to stand for this. But I guess we have to wait and see how it plays out, and maybe there's additional evidence we don't know yet. You'd hate to think that whenever you give money to a cause you believe in, you'd be on the hook for whatever actions might be taken down the road that could land you in jail. I mean, that's kind of a mind-boggling prospect in itself. But we'll watch and see where this goes. I would imagine if they do decide to pursue charges, it's going to be a slap on the wrist at most.
Okay. Taylor Stevens, just we have to head to our second break here, but anything else to add on this particular story before we move on?
Yeah, I think one other interesting element, just quickly, is that the Fraternal Order of Police have come down pretty hard against Kitchen, saying that he should not be donating his taxpayer salary toward the destruction of state property. And they have called for him to step down from the committees that he serves on related to law enforcement, and calling on Gill to charge Kitchen as a co-conspirator to the vandalism. So Fraternal Order of Police has come out pretty strong on this, and that's just another interesting component of the story.
Okay, Taylor Stevens, reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you for filling us in on this. We're going to head to another break. When we come back, we will try to squeeze in a story about homeless encampments in Salt Lake City, and then we'll head to our underplayed stories of the week. This is Behind the Headlines, a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Roger McDonough. Back in a moment.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Cafe Ibis Gallery Deli at 52 Federal Avenue in Logan, featuring triple certified coffee, espresso bar, and pastries Tuesday through Saturday, 7 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. Click Cafe Online Ordering at cafeibis.com.
Did a supernatural beast cause the death of Sir Charles Baskerville?
He set the dogs on me!
Miss Stapleton?
I hear the pack behind me! I must keep running!
Miss Stapleton?
James Marsters, Seamus Deaver, and Sarah Drew star in the Sherlock Holmes classic, The Hound of the Baskervilles, next time on LA Theater Works.
Tune in Friday night at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Bethany Rogers, Taylor Stevens, and Robert Gerke. It is our Friday morning local news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Weigh in on what you've been hearing by calling 801-355-8255, or again, you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. And well, I'd meant to say, well, we might have enough time here. Taylor and Bethany once again collaborating on a story about homelessness in Salt Lake City. And the headline of the story is, "Have Salt Lake City Homeless Encampments Gotten Out of Control Again?" And maybe to start with, and once more, I don't know which of you to direct this question to, but where is that question that the headline is posing, where is that question coming from?
Yeah, I think this question refers to pre-Operation Rio Grande, when Salt Lake City had these encampments that, you know, state leaders, city leaders all seemed to be in agreement were out of control, led to the Operation Rio Grande law enforcement campaign in the area to clean it up, and also to the closure of the Road Home, the opening of three new homeless resource centers in the Salt Lake City area to kind of create more resources and break up the singular population that was camping. So there have been a lot of investments in trying to sort of disrupt the camping element. But we've seen camping, encampments getting bigger, and this story sort of looks at all of the complex factors that might be contributing to the supposed growth
right.
of the encampments.
And one of those contributing factors, and again, yes, supposed growth, because it's hard to say specifically because of this factor, is the pandemic that we're living through, right?
Yeah, and the reason it's hard to say whether the encampments are growing or not is the encampments always tend to get bigger in the summer as more people are comfortable sleeping outside. In the winter, more people tend to go into the shelters. Not to say there isn't a camping element in the winter, but definitely with the pandemic, one thought is that this could just be more visible because there aren't public buildings where many people experiencing homelessness spend a lot of time. Those aren't open. So the downtown library, for example. So more people are spending time outside is one thought of why there might be more visibility to this issue. Another component that's related to the coronavirus and with the closure of public buildings is that people have fewer resources as far as restroom access.
Yeah.
And that has led, we've seen, to more people using the restroom on the streets because they don't have access to other facilities. And that could be another component of why people are feeling like this is uniquely challenging right now.
And who is it that is actually expressing concern about this? I know city council members, some business owners, they say that it's getting out of hand and they want to see action taken. Who are we talking about there?
Yeah, as you said, we've got state leaders who are raising concern about this issue. Salt Lake City Council is talking about the encampments. They're receiving more complaints, they say, than they have in a long time, as well as business owners who are, frustrated by the presence of people. And, I should say that caught in the middle of this are these people who may, in some cases, not have anywhere else to go, who don't have access to the same resources that they had pre-pandemic, and who are kind of just being pushed around the city by the law enforcement response to the encampments.
Is it also that people who are, who are experiencing homelessness are not comfortable necessarily going into sheltered spaces because of the fact that, you're more likely to be in close proximity to other people, and that's one of the things that we're all being told not to do?
Yeah, that's definitely another piece of this. We went out to an encampment and spoke with a number of individuals who say that they feel more comfortable camping right now than being within a shelter. They have gotten the coronavirus largely under control within Salt Lake City's homeless shelters. There was a big outbreak early on, but as of right now, there's only, I think the latest report I saw was 6 confirmed cases within the homeless shelters. So, there's definitely a risk mitigation there as far as camping. But the other thing that we know is that the Men's Resource Center has reduced its capacity and overflow options are limited. So to some degree, even if you did want to seek shelter right now, the system's pretty full.
Huh. So then what would cleaning up, the encampments, quote unquote, mean in that instance, if there's nowhere to send people?
Yeah, that's a good question. And we ask a lot of people that, and it comes down to, this is a complicated problem and people kind of don't want it in their backyard, but don't very often have ideas for where these people should go. And so I think part of the visibility is a recognition that this is a systemic issue that is going to need more resources and more housing, as some folks that we spoke with mentioned, than just moving people around so that it's an invisible problem.
A lot of questions that are raised there, Taylor, about what those sort of systemic overarching changes to the ways that we're tackling homeless, what those might look like, or if there are new things being implemented in northern Utah on that front. Kind of a big topic to open up, but is there anything you can say there?
Yeah, one thing I can mention is that the city council is working to put together what they're calling an encampment resolution program. And what that would do is, in some of these entrenched encampments where, they come in and clean it up and then it sets right back up and community members are being affected by it, what they say they want to do is, and this program is still being drafted, but they want to work with service providers to find a place for those campers to go by an agreed upon date, whether that's a shelter, a treatment facility, into housing. And then what the city would do is close down that camp and try to take some steps to prevent campers from setting back up in the area. So it's a pretty involved process. So this sounds like the city would only want to use this in situations of what they're calling severe entrenchment. But that's one potential solution that they're looking at for encampments specifically. The city's also mentioned, maintaining a focus on housing is important because people can't get out of homelessness unless they have access to affordable housing, deeply affordable housing.
Yeah, on the first item that you mentioned, here we give you an end date, we give you warning that we're going to close this thing down in a couple of weeks, but then, and then you do it. But again, that would seem to have the same kind of not in my backyard problem of it ballooning up somewhere else. And maybe I'll bring Robert Gerke, the news columnist, in on that point before we head to our underplayed stories of the week. Robert Gerke, homeless encampments in Salt Lake City. Your thoughts?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's no easy solution, right? This is an issue we've been grappling with as a community for quite some time. Obviously you feel for the people who are on the street. Some of them want to be there, but I would say most of them would rather have housing, right? But you also feel for the business owners who, the restaurants that are doing outdoor dining have complained about the homeless people coming and going and sort of disrupting the experience in that regard. The pandemic has exacerbated all of these long-standing problems that we've had. I think one of the interesting aspects that I hadn't really thought about that was in Taylor's story last week was they have a hard time finding a place to go to the bathroom now because places where they used to be able to go are turning them away in many instances, and that creates obvious problems. So, we're trying to figure out a bridge, I guess, a Band-Aid solution to try to alleviate some of these conflicts in the near term. But as Taylor mentioned, I mean, the only long-term solution to the homeless crisis is homes, and we're still way behind the curve in that. And we still haven't really seen the, influx of pandemic-related evictions and the strains that's going to be putting on the system, too. And so, we've got a problem now, a problem that is likely to get worse before it gets better. And then we've got the winter in the not too far distant future.
Right.
It's imperative, I think, that the leaders get their hands around this problem and do it fairly quickly.
All right. We're going to have to cut that story short because we're so low on time, and I want to save some time for our final segment, Underplayed Stories of the Week. Taylor Stevens, I'll say thanks again for your reporting and for covering this for us, and also Bethany Rogers, who covered the story as well. But Bethany Rogers, let's bring you in for your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
So my story comes from Becky Jacobs, and she has been writing a lot about the 100-year anniversary of suffrage. Yeah. And in the story that she wrote this, and one of the stories that she wrote this week, she talked about an initiative called Do It for Grandma, which encourages, is where grandmas are encouraging, I guess, their grandchildren to register to vote and sharing their personal family history, memories of people, their own grandmothers and great-grandmothers who didn't have the right to vote and the ability to vote, and sort of encouraging them to exercise that civic right.
It's a great pick and a great look at history as well, and also always the stark reminder that it's not that long ago that women didn't have the right to vote. Taylor Stevens, your pick for Underplayed Story.
Yeah, I want to highlight the coverage by my colleague by my colleague Courtney Tanner on schools reopening this week. She had a great story about the number of teachers who have retired or resigned. She looked at opening day at a Murray school and also has done some reporting on Utah teachers who haven't received much of their PPE that they were promised.
Right.
So worth checking out as schools reopen. She's got all of the angles covered there.
Thank you. And Gerke, quickly, your pick for Underplayed Story.
Yeah, I wanted to highlight a story that Brian Maffley had that was in the paper this morning, and it was about an unprecedented fire year that we're having this year. Experts are pointing to COVID and people trying to get outdoors as sort of a cause of that. They're in the process of starting wildfires that are causing a lot of devastation. We can see the smoky air today.
Thank you, Robert.
Coming from California, but It's worth reading, especially as we head into summer dry months.
I'm sorry, I got to let us go. That's it for Behind the Headlines. Thanks very much for listening.
Thank you. Take care.
This is Utah Public Radio, statewide member-supported service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSO Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, also heard online at upr.org and on the UPR app.